Welcome to Bankless, where we explore the frontier of internet money and internet finance. This is how to get started, how to get better, and how to front run the opportunity. I'm Ryan Sean Adams. I'm joined by David Hoffman, and we're here to help you become more bankless. David, Vitalik on the podcast again, another cannot miss episode. What did we talk about?
We talked about legitimacy, this invisible force that Vitalik has named as legitimacy that we are exploring in today's podcast. And we go through the ways that the concept of legitimacy impacts our lives as individuals and our lives as part of a greater society. And Vitalik makes the claim that legitimacy is one of the world's most powerful forces. And as a society, we don't really talk about it, but it really guides a lot of our day-to-day lives. And it's even more true in the cryptocurrency space. And I think the fact that legitimacy is one of the most powerful forces in the cryptocurrency space is perhaps why this space is so revolutionary. It answers the questions as to why this industry is so bottom up, why this industry is by the people for the people, because the people are enabled to bestow legitimacy on the things that they see are good. And so we talk about a number of different subjects, both in and outside of the world of cryptocurrency, where legitimacy really has the reins as to what is true and how the world moves forward. And so really enjoy this conversation with Vitalik Buterin, as always.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I'd say a couple of things that's really impressed upon me with this episode. I feel like if you don't understand the concept of legitimacy, even if you don't call it legitimacy, you don't really understand what's going on in crypto. Mm-hmm. Because legitimacy is really the answer to so many of the questions, like even basic questions. David, why is cryptocurrency trading over $2 trillion, mm-hmm. right? When it grew like, you know, 11 to 12 years ago is when it started. How did we come this far? The answer, legitimacy. Mm-hmm. Why are NFTs valuable? Why was a Beeple NFT? Why did that sell for $68 million? Answer, legitimacy. Mm-hmm. How come when I try to fork a Bitcoin, how come you can't fork your own Bitcoin, create your own mm-hmm. alternative? How come I can't do it? How come there is only one Bitcoin? Answer, legitimacy. Why do we have confidence that Ethereum's monetary policy won't change in the direction of increasing inflation, but only will change in the direction of decreasing inflation? Answer, legitimacy. Like, mm-hmm. it's kind of the answer. It's almost like the theory of everything for crypto. And until you understand it, I don't know that you have comprehensive answers to all of these most common questions. Vitalik said, it's legitimacy all the way down. I think he's right.
Yeah, and we can even go all the way back into history, modern history, and talk about the current situation going on in Russia with Alexei Navalny. But we can go all the way back to just very historical, primal examples of how humans choose to coordinate and how legitimacy is like this emergent, higher order of acceptance of society, and how when everyone chooses the same outcome, that outcome is bestowed with legitimacy. And we can kind of build our social organizations upon that initial kernel of legitimacy, and that initial kernel of legitimacy carries on forwards into the future and gains legitimacy every step of the way. So while it is extremely apt for the world of crypto, it also helps answer so many of the other questions that I think are really confusing to people today in modern society. Like, why is the left and the right in America have so much strife between them? Why do we distrust institutions? Legitimacy has a hand in answering, I think, every modern day social question.
Yeah. So Vitalik is like, again, part technical mind, part philosopher, part anthropologist, just mm-hmm. has a fantastic lens on legitimacy. So he was the perfect guest to explain it. And he wrote a fantastic post that we based this episode on. So that is the bulk of the conversation. You're not going to want to miss it. We also, toward the end, we talked about Vitalik's thoughts on ultrasound money, on mm-hmm. Ether issuance. I thought that was definitely stay tuned for that. That was a very interesting part of the conversation. And we ended in him giving us a snapshot of time. Ethereum in 2021, what is in store for it as a network? Will it become a global store of value reserve asset? He even reflected on that too. So this is an episode you do not want to miss. David and I are giving some more have some more conversation about this episode in the debrief. So if you are a premium subscriber, you should already have access to that at shows.banklesshq.com. So with that, we want to thank the sponsors that made this episode possible. MetaMask is your go-to wallet for the bankless journey. If you're going bankless, you need MetaMask, period. Browser and mobile, get them both. This is your tool to unlock the world of DeFi. Here's my favorite part. Now you can swap tokens directly in MetaMask with a single swipe. This has got to be the easiest way to trade Ethereum tokens. Choose a token you own, a token to exchange it with, and get your quotes. If you like what you see, you hit swap. That's it. What makes swaps so useful is what happens behind the scenes. It compares DEXs, aggregators, and market makers to find you the best price with the lowest network fees and the least slippage. This means you can swap a wider range of tokens, and swaps can even automatically split up your trade to give you access to better liquidity. You don't even have to think about it. Try it out. Download MetaMask for desktop or mobile now at metamask.io and start swapping.
Balancer is DeFi's most powerful automated market maker. Typical AMMs just have two tokens inside of one liquidity pool, which can lead to fractured liquidity across the many pairs in DeFi. With Balancer, you can access the full power of multiple tokens inside of one single AMM, which unlocks an entirely new playing field of possibility. This makes Balancer an awesome building block for so many different use cases. Balancer pools can make asset indexes, but instead of paying fees to portfolio managers, Balancer lets you collect fees from traders who use your portfolio for liquidity. Additionally, Balancer smart pools can be programmed to have properties that change according to predetermined rules, such as changing the swap fee based on market conditions, or even liquidity bootstrapping pools, which can help you launch and distribute your token with day one liquidity. At Bankless, we used a liquidity bootstrapping pool to sell our BAP t-shirts to much success. Balancer V2 brings powerful new features that makes your money work even harder for you. In V2, idle tokens are capable of generating yield in DeFi without sacrificing liquidity in the pool. To top things off, Balancer is reimbursing gas costs with BAL rewards, meaning that your gas fees are reimbursed up to the cost of the transaction with the Balancer governance token. Balancer's mission is to become the primary source of liquidity in DeFi by providing the most flexible and powerful platform for asset management and decentralized exchange. Dive into the Balancer pools at pools.balancer.exchange today. All right, welcome, Bankless Nation. We have Vitalik Buterin back on the podcast. And Vitalik, you recently wrote a piece titled "The Most Important Scarce Resource is Legitimacy." And we are going to be talking a lot about legitimacy today on this episode. Vitalik, welcome back to Bankless. How are you doing today, sir?
Thank you. I'm doing great. And it's good to be back on Bankless, the greatest Ethereum podcast at TM.
Wow. You heard it here, folks.
It was a TM. I want to know who has the TM, though. Hopefully that is settled on Ethereum and not in the nation state, right? That's what we do on Bankless.
Vitalik, you started off your blog post illustrating this massive difference between Ethereum and Bitcoin security budgets versus how much each of these respective systems allocates towards research and development expenses. You said Bitcoin is paying miners $38 million in block rewards plus $5 million more in fees per day, and Ethereum is doing $19.5 million in block rewards plus $18 million in transaction fees per day, all going to security, which is a necessary expense. But you juxtapose this with how much the Ethereum Foundation has to spend on research and development, which is just $30 million per year. And you do a similar compare and contrast versus like the Bitcoin innovation expenditures as well, which is similarly very, very low versus the security budget for the Bitcoin blockchain. But you didn't do this to suggest that Ethereum and Bitcoin should find ways to direct some of their security budget to pay for human salaries for research and development, but rather as a thought experiment as to why this crazy discrepancy in funding exists and why we are okay with massively overpaying for security. So two paragraphs that I want to read out that are in the blog post themselves for the listeners that haven't actually read the piece. You wrote, "Even though we could easily identify some valuable public goods to redirect some funding to as a one-off, making a regular institutionalized pattern of such decisions carries risks of political chaos and capture that are in the long run not with it. We are faced with this interesting fact that the organisms that are Bitcoin and Ethereum ecosystems are capable of summoning up billions of dollars of capital, but have strange and hard to understand restrictions on where that capital can go. And it's a social force that underlies all sorts of extremely powerful mechanisms far beyond the blockchain space. For this reason, that will be clear in the upcoming sections of the article, I will give this powerful social force a name: legitimacy, the powerful social force that is creating this effect is worth understanding. And so, Vitalik, we would love to explore the power and value of legitimacy with you today. So let's start with this very basic question. What is legitimacy?
So the thought experiment that I guess started the post with, right, it's basically a kind of calling attention to this strange fact that like ecosystems and like groups of humans more generally, they have a kind of physical ability to summon up resources. Like each of us has the physical ability to summon up a certain number of hours of effort every week. We have a certain amount of physical resources at hand and so forth. But then there also seems to be this different thing, this kind of social ability to actually summon up and direct resources toward particular tasks. And our ability to socially direct resources toward particular tasks is often kind of wildly out of sync with the physical ability to direct resources that's in the hands of each individual person, right? And so in this example, like we clearly have the physical ability to summon up resources worth billions of dollars potentially to any task, but we socially seem to have the ability to put those resources toward network security, but we don't have the same ability to put those resources toward other things. And like funding protocol research and development is one big example, right? And so you start thinking about why this is the case, right? And we also start thinking about, well, why is it the case that we have these kind of socially mediated resources in a lot of other contexts more broadly, right? So like a bit after this, I brought up this case of the Steam project and how Justin Sun bought up a bunch of the Steam tokens and he started using them to try to kind of consolidate power and sort of do an authoritarian takeover of the Steam network. But then the community just said, like, you know, no, screw you. We're going to make our own fork and we're going to delete your money in the fork, right? And the fact that this was possible is basically proof that, well, actually, Justin Sun, regardless of what any ledger theoretically said, never actually owns those coins, right? Like, if you own something, you have the ability to use it for whatever you want. Well, he clearly, as demonstrated by reality, did not have the ability to use those coins for whatever he wanted. His ownership of the coins was actually kind of controlled by these unwritten social contracts that the Steam company had with the community that he then inherited when he bought Steam the company. And so we have these situations where basically large collections of resources are controlled not by like physical force, not even by private keys, and not by any kind of formal arrangement of individuals, but by a social contract, right? And so like this is what happens in the hands of, like with, say, a blockchain, right? Like the Ethereum blockchain, for example, like it's clearly capable of making the decision to switch from pumping $5 million a year into proof of work to pump, or 5 million ETH a year into proof of work to pumping 1 million a year into proof of stake. But it would not be capable of switching to pumping 1 million ETH a year into, say, life extension research, even though like I personally really love life extension research and lots of other people love life extension research. So like we need to just like properly think about and understand this concept. Like, what does it mean for coins to be owned by social contracts? Like what is actually happening in this phenomenon? How do we describe this phenomenon? And if we understand this phenomenon better, like it's clearly this very powerful social force that, you know, we could potentially even try to like apply and try to use it to fund more at all kinds of good things that we like. So then I get to this concept of legitimacy, right? And so the idea behind legitimacy is basically that, like, in society in general, there's a lot of cases where there's some action or there's some pattern of behavior, and there's this shared expectation that, like, some pattern of behavior is something that's supposed to happen, and everyone plays their part in enacting the facts that this is a pattern of behavior that's supposed to happen because, like, at least in big part because they expect everyone else to share that pattern as well, right? So, like, the simplest example of this is, like, which side of the road do you drive on, right? And I mean, for most people listening to this, it's, you know, you'd be on the right side of the road, but no, for some, in some places on the left side of the road. And like, there isn't really any like coherent reason why one is better than the other, but
There's no right side of the road maximalist kind of Vitalik?
Yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe there are a few, but like, again, to be honest, like, I'm not really a car person, so I had to think for a couple of seconds to remember, like, which side of the road is which. the point is that, like, even if, you know, tomorrow the police completely disappeared, you know, there are some things that would start going wrong, but like, I would predict that almost all people, like say in the United States, would just peacefully keep driving on the correct side of the road and not driving on the incorrect side of the road, because they know that, you know, if they start driving on the incorrect side of the road, like that's just going against the consensus is the thing that's bad both for society and for themselves. There's just this high cost of disrupting the consensus, and it's a high cost both to the, kind of the wider society and just a high risk to themselves personally. And so they just continue driving on the correct side of the road. And by doing that, they just sort of become part of the process of enacting this consensus. And this is something that exists in a lot of social situations, right? So like an example of this closer to home in the blockchain space is like, if you look at something like the DAO fork, right? Like, there's the question of, you know, was the DAO fork legitimate, right? And if you think that the DAO fork is legitimate, then when the DAO fork is happening, then you're going to, you know, go and peacefully download the Ethereum client that implements the DAO fork. And if you run some Ethereum service, you're going to hook up that client to that particular, or your Ethereum service to the client that implements the DAO fork. When you talk about ETH, you're going to talk about ETH as being the coins that are on the DAO fork. But if you do not like recognize the DAO fork as being legitimate, then you're going to do the opposite, and you're just going to keep running the client that does not implement the DAO fork, right? And so this is also one of those situations where like you have a there are reasons to want to favor one side or the other, but there also is this kind of strong overriding pressure to sort of favor the side that everyone else broadly accepts. And like this pattern of kind of everyone watching what everyone else's expectations are and forming their own expectations based on that. And like this kind of pattern, right, of like everyone watching everyone else and this being motivated even in part because like there is even an over like this big self-interest in going along with the consensus. Like this pattern is the thing that I call legitimacy, right? And so like in 2016, like we found, you know, the DAO fork is what was legitimate. And in 2017, the Bitcoin SegWit, for example, was legitimate. And like, I'm using the word legitimate in this very kind of positive sense, right? This is positive as opposed to normative. Like something can be legitimate even if you don't like it, right? Like, you know, the government of North Korea is legitimate inside of North Korea because there's a pattern of acting like it is. This is the kind of like the social force that we're talking about, right? Like it's, you know, basically which side of, you know, the equilibrium could fall either way. And the question is like, which side does it fall on? And that ends up just like deciding a huge number of things in the world.
Guys, when I read this post, it was sort of a missing link for me, because I think legitimacy is a hidden force, to use another popular podcaster's vernacular, behind so much of what happens in crypto. And it answers so many of crypto's frequently asked questions. And that's why it is so important to understand what it is and to get your mind wrapped around this as a mental model. I think one thing you're saying, Vitalik, is basically in 2016, with the DAO hard fork, there was a fight for legitimacy of which is the real Ethereum, quote unquote. And it seems to be the case that the real Ethereum is the Ethereum that did hard fork as a result of maybe the market cap of Ethereum, the DeFi economy that's built on top of it, the community that the Ethereum economy has versus the Ethereum Classic Fork. So that was really a battle, a social coordination game for legitimacy. That's how you'd frame it.
Absolutely.
Vitalik, just to recap and define a few things that you said leading up to this, is you talked about this Steam blockchain versus Justin Sun and the DAO fork. And I want to just make sure that this concept of legitimacy is formally instantiated in the listener's brain, where you're saying that Justin Sun didn't actually own the Steam tokens that controlled over the Steam blockchain, even though he had the private keys that controlled over the address that held these tokens. Because there was this invisible force, this hidden force that exists out there in the world, that force was allowed to influence the control over the system. Mm-hmm. And the force of legitimacy actually put the power of ownership over the Steam ecosystem into the hands of the community and away from Justin Sun. And now that this event happened, we can retroactively look at what happened and say that, well, Justin Sun had the tokens, but they were removed from him by this invisible power that is legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And so while we can't feel it, while it doesn't exist anywhere, it's not tangible, there is this hidden social force out there, kind of like the dark matter of the universe, this hidden force of legitimacy that is directing our lives, both in the meat space and in the crypto space, and perhaps especially in the crypto space. Anything you want to add on to that?
No, I think that's definitely an excellent summary. And I think these kinds of hidden forces are definitely everywhere. And they're extremely strong in the crypto space, I think, because the crypto space is really all about just kind of trying to summon up value in entirely out of a conception of legitimacy in a lot of ways, right? Like, the crypto space controls no physical resources. The crypto space controls no legal rights. The crypto space controls no guns and boats. So what gives Bitcoin the value that it has? What gives ETH the value that it has? Legitimacy is pretty much entirely responsible for these things.
It's very much a battle for hearts and minds. It's a battle on the layer zero, sort of the social layer, as we've said before. I want to prompt back to the original story that David opened with, just to see if we can tie that on a bow and maybe answer the question of why legitimacy was such a factor there. And then we can define legitimacy a bit more in other contexts. But the reason that Ethereum couldn't just siphon off issuance and put it into a development fund was because we don't, there's no legitimacy in the governance of that development fund. So if you proposed an EIP, for instance, to create Ethereum issuance to fund charity of your choice, that would be an illegitimate use of the Ethereum social contract. I remember, just a quick story, back in 2019, this was actually sort of a real thing that was contemplated. We were in the depths of the bear market, Ethereum. There was kind of the question of, is Ethereum dead? Price was down. The community was discouraged. Even though we were building so much during that time, it was sort of a discouraging time for many being in the space. And an EIP was proposed to answer the question that you posited at the beginning of your article, which is, how do we make sure that Ethereum client development at the protocol level is funded into the future? And so EIP 2025 was proposed, and the title of this EIP was Block Rewards Proposal for Funding ETH 1.x. And what it actually did was it proposed funding to a good cause, which is the future development of Ethereum and Ethereum clients and the Ethereum protocol. And there were a number of great people behind this. Kevin Owocki was one who created a fantastic distribution mechanism, public goods funding mechanism in Gitcoin. But the difference is, this is embedding some sort of issuance to some third party, unnamed third party, on the base layer, which is a question of legitimacy. And at the time, I felt like Ethereum needed a bit of a wake-up call, a bit more of kind of a Bitcoiner mindset of what could happen if we are naive about the issue of legitimacy. I didn't call it then. And I created EIP 2208 as just kind of a joke. I'm not sure it landed among everyone, but this was sort of a riff off of the other proposal. And I basically proposed an EIP to report to award block rewards to thought leaders, people in the media space, people with great Twitter accounts. I think some in the Ethereum community felt like I wasn't being maybe sanctimonious enough about the EIP process. It was a joke, but I surfaced the joke in order to...
That was the point.
Yeah. That was the point, satire. But I surfaced the joke in order to provoke this very conversation. Mm. If an EIP could be proposed to siphon off issuance for development, why couldn't it be proposed to siphon off issuance for anything? Mm. And then what's the governance process for that EIP getting passed? And it was very hard to justify the legitimacy of those things. Any thoughts or reflections on all of that?
Yeah, I think you definitely gave a good summary. I would say one of the things that became obvious as a result of that is, and then here we can probably kind of go down a bit to what I talked about in the next section of the post, is like where legitimacy comes from, right? Like what kinds of sources of legitimacy there are. And my point there is that like, legitimacy is something that can theoretically come from a lot of places, but it's really heavily dependent on like, human coordination and consensus. And so legitimacy can most easily come from like things that intuitively appeal across broad groups of people. And so I gave a few examples, right? Like one example of a legitimacy is just legitimacy by brute force, right? Like if someone takes over some community or like exerts a really strong influence in some community, even if they're not liked, if they're feared by enough people, then people kind of get into this mode where like people realize that no one else is brave enough to stand up against them. And so they themselves start being not being brave enough to stand against them. And like, this isn't a pattern of legitimacy that everyone likes, but you know, it is still a pattern of legitimacy, right?
Is an example of this the nation state, brute force, Vitalik?
Sure, yes. So, you know, many nation states are definitely an example of this. A second example is legitimacy by fairness, right? And you know, this is a conception of legitimacy that I think, you know, we all consider to be much more pro-social, right? And so something is like gains legitimacy if it's perceived as like satisfying some intuitive conception of, you know, being fair, of not unfairly favoring some groups of people over other groups of people. The concept of credible neutrality that I wrote about last year like kind of really ties into this, right? And I think this gets to the core of why I'd say, yeah, funding network security is much more easily accepted than funding development, because network security is a very cleanly defined thing. And it's also a process that at least formally anyone can kind of come in and participate in on a kind of formally equal terms. And so it's something that people fairly easily accept as like, yes, this is something we all agree is necessary. And yes, this is something that we all agree is not a like giveaway to a certain group of people, right? And so we're okay with funding blockchains for network security. But once you start funding developments, the problem is that I think EIP 2025, it didn't just say we want to redirect 0.045 ETH per block to developers. It said we want to redirect 0.045 ETH per block or whatever the number was, maybe it was 044, to this specific group of people that we consider to be the ETH 1.x team, right? And so in order to be okay with that EIP, like you basically had to have an opinion, not just about the cause, but also about that particular group of people. And so that's not a very socially scalable thing to try to convince people of. And that's something that just does not benefit from like legitimacy by fairness at all, right? So now, theoretically, like if someone had proposed it, like if Gitcoin grants quadratic funding had existed and someone had proposed Gitcoin grants quadratic funding as a recipient of that 0.044, then like maybe it would have been more successful. And like maybe one could imagine, you know, a world sometime down the future where the Ethereum ecosystem has a big enough funding crisis that people realize that, you know, public goods funding is something just needs to be expanded upon, and someone suggests, hey, you know, like let's take like 20% of like say the EAP 1559 burn and direct it into Gitcoin grants, and like that actually gets accepted. Like that's something that I think the Ethereum ecosystem is far away from today, but if in the future, like, there's just a large necessity for public goods on a larger scale than is possible with just people's existing funds, like, that's something that conceivably the community could move toward accepting, and it would have an easier time accepting that than it would accepting, hey, let's give 0.045 ETH per block to, like, Alexey Akunov's team, or to Justin Drake's team, or to some team led by myself, or to pretty much anything that's, like, organized around specific people. So that's, like, another example. But, at the same time, like, even still, like, the thing that has even more legitimacy is, like, instead of trying to change the layer one base, or change the base layer, is to try to do these things at higher level layers of the ecosystem, right? Because, like, status quo pressure itself is something that that has higher legitimacy at layer one than it does at layer two. So that's legitimacy by fairness. There's also legitimacy by process. So legitimacy by process basically says if a process is fair, then outputs of that process are fair. There's legitimacy by performance. So if a process had good results in the past, then that process becomes something that gains legitimacy over time. There's legitimacy by participation. So a mechanism where people feel like they can be part of enacting the process is a mechanism that people are likely to accept more easily. So there's all of these kind of complicated concepts that affect people's perceptions of what is legitimate and what isn't, right? And, like, they interact in complicated ways, right? And, like, the way that public goods funding happens within the Ethereum ecosystem and even beyond the Ethereum ecosystem is very heavily influenced by all of these things.
So these are some of the sources of where legitimacy comes from. And I want to kind of quickly maybe recap some of these for folks. So you said legitimacy by brute force, we defined that. Mm-hmm. Legitimacy by fairness, we talked about that a bit. An example of legitimacy by a process, something that many listeners are familiar with, of course, is probably a democracy, mm-hmm. right? So if I have the ability to vote on a new leader every 4 years, I'm probably less angry when the person I picked doesn't go through. Mm-hmm. And I'm less likely to revolt because, hey, this is just part of the process. I get to pick every 4 years, so does everyone else. In another 4 years, I'll get another shot at it. So I'm not going to lead the revolution and support, candidate X mm-hmm. As a result. That's an example of legitimacy by process, right?
Right. Now, so legitimacy by process goes from processes to outcomes. The one right after that is legitimacy by performance, which goes from outcomes to process, right? So I gave the example that democracy is an example of legitimacy by process. Successful dictatorships sometimes are described as getting legitimacy by performance. Like, this person ran the country for 30, or this group of people ran the country for 30 years, and, like, we've had 6.5% economic growth for most of those years when the rest of the world was moving forward more slowly. And so, like, they gain legitimacy as a process as a result of, like, them being able to, like, achieve this outcome.
I can't.
Now, once again,
I was going to say, I just can't help, like, weaving in some kind of crypto lessons here, because I feel like there are many cryptocurrencies right now that get at least some short-term legitimacy by performance. So people observe this, your coin price goes up. Oh, It must mean that this is a good asset. It must mean that this chain is decentralized. It must mean that this chain is long lasting. Chains like the Binance chain, for example, they are having some success with DeFi, mm-hmm. quote unquote.
Yeah.
And so this is legitimacy by performance, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's absolutely true. And legitimacy by performance is definitely one of those interesting things, because it's often how a kind of intellectual revolution happens. Like, there's this sort of equilibrium of conformism among, the right-thinking people, where the right-thinking people have certain ideas that they think are legitimate, but then something outside of those ideas just starts performing, and it keeps performing, and it keeps performing. And the people within this kind of self-affirming circle of intellectuals just keep ignoring it for a long time, but then eventually, like, people that are kind of further away from the center, like, they just see, hey, this thing on the outside is performing well, and, we don't give a crap about these principles, like, look, this thing is successful, and, like, that often ends up overturning things, right? And that's something that some, like, once again, you know, I have to keep giving this disclaimer, right? Like, the legitimacy does not, something being legitimate does not mean that you like the thing, right? And sometimes the thing that you like loses legitimacy and a thing that you don't like gains legitimacy. One interesting thing that I think the US might be experiencing over the last 10 years or so is actually, it feels like the process of democracy is actually losing some legitimacy and perform. So, like, one example of this, right, is that on the Democrat side, like, we saw the whole not my president movement, you know, hashtag back in 2017. And that's a very direct and literal example of basically just declaring, hey, I'm going to dip my toes into, like, basically saying, well, you know, too bad if he was elected by democratic process. Like, I just think that this new person is horrible, and that just overrides the process. And then, of course, on the other side, you know, in 2021, we saw, you know, people denying the legitimacy of the election results, right? And so on both sides, like, you, if you want to try to kind of, like, analyze that from a social science perspective, you know, that's a process, just like people are sort of dipping their toes into the idea of just not accepting the outcome of the process and just acting like, well, if they don't like the results, they should just act like the result isn't a legitimate result. And you could, you can argue performance is, like, one of the reasons behind that, right? So, like, this is an example of how transitions in legitimacy could happen. And, like, once again, you know, sometimes these transitions happen in directions that you like. Sometimes these transitions happen in directions that you don't like, right? In the crypto space, another example of this is proof of stake, right? Like, the legitimacy of proof of stake, like, does a chain running on proof of stake sort of get the aura of being a first class decentralized system that you want to put your applications onto? And that's something that I think is, like, is rising over time, right? Like, maybe 5 years ago, the proof of work had much more legitimacy, but now, as Ethereum's proof of stake is getting closer, as we see more and more chains running on proof of stake, like, it's becoming just more and more accepted by this larger and larger community. And that's something that, you know, is definitely really disliked by this kind of self-affirming clique of intellectuals within the Bitcoin proof of work camp. And they just, like, keep on shouting their arguments about, no, nothing at stake, no costless simulation, no rich get richer. And now, of course, you know, we have our intellectual rebuttals to that, but, like, it's almost the fact that the intellectual rebuttals are now gaining steam is, I mean, like, in part, I want to think that it's because my arguments are logically amazing, but, it, you know, we, as you said, it's not just because the arguments are logically amazing. It's also because of legitimacy by performance and this kind of hidden social force that's subconsciously influencing everyone. And Ethereum just looks like something that's strong and looks like something that's rising. And so that's something that, you know, people want to kind of rally behind, right? So,
Let's talk about two more, Vitalik, that you have these like theories of legitimacy. As we said, we talked about continuity, fairness, process, performance. You mentioned very briefly legitimacy by participation, but I think that's an important one in the context of crypto and has many, many aspects. So the fact that anyone can open an Ethereum address, right? All you need is an internet connection. Mm-hmm. That's something you don't get in the traditional banking system, for instance. So that is more participation. The fact that anyone in a more decentralized proof of stake network can spin up an Ethereum node, validator node, provided that you have the necessary stake to validate. It's much more permissionless. Democracies have legitimacy by not just process, but also participation, in that every citizen has the ability to vote. Talk a bit more about legitimacy by participation. Then we'll talk about the last one, which is legitimacy by continuity. And that'll give us a grounding for the rest of this. So what about participation?
Sure. So legitimacy by participation basically just means, you know, if the process just gives you and gives its participants an ability to actually shape and be part of the outcome of the process, then this is something that people are likely to accept, right? And participation is not just fairness, right? It's like part of it is fairness because systems that everyone can participate in are systems that are more likely to be fair. But it's also a somewhat different psychological force, right? It's more like if you, it's like a desire to have for sort of psychological self-consistency. Like once you go to the ballot box and you make a vote, like you feel invested in the process and like you feel like, you know, you are a person who is part of implementing the democracy thing. And so this, you know, makes you want to also be a person who is part of implementing the democracy thing in other contexts, right? And, you know, in the case of the blockchain, like your ability to run a node is definitely legitimacy by participation. And it's also other kinds of legitimacy as well, right? It's also just kind of like intellectual legitimacy of just the idea that self-verification is important, and it's like a key part of what makes something a blockchain instead of making it a centralized system. There's some legitimacy by fairness in there as well. Gitcoin grants is also another example of legitimacy by participation. Like, you know, you yourself can affect which direction the matching pod goes if like you go and participate. So I guess like one example of this, right, is that like there are fair systems that you can't participate in, right? So like, for example, if you're 16 years old, then you cannot yet vote. But even if you're 16, like you might still be convinced by the intellectual arguments that, you know, the average 16-year-old is a lower quality political participant than the average adult. And so like we can debate how true that is, but like, let's leave that aside. Like, you might be convinced by this argument, and you might like, and so, you know, you might still accept democracy being fair, despite the fact that only 18-year-olds can participate. But you know, you're still not going to get the legitimacy by participation component. But this might be part of why, you know, there actually are all of these like youth political movements and like schools and, you know, often actively encourage like kind of teenagers to start, you know, doing civic engagement of some kind, right? Like it's this alternative route to actually getting legitimacy by participation kind of started earlier. So this is definitely something that happens a lot. And I definitely think that like decentralized systems heavily benefit from this because like there's no part of a decentralized system that is closed off to you, right? If you want to read the chain, you can read the chain. If you want to send a transaction, you can send a transaction. If you want to participate in consensus, you can go participate in consensus. So like that aspect where like there's no part of the chain that of the chain's activity that like is not something that you can conceivably be part of is something that I think like it does really contribute to the legitimacy of public chains. And it's something that I think like is one reason why kind of like more fully decentralized systems like Ethereum and Bitcoin are likely to have more legitimacy than these like more semi-centralized chains that really that like intrinsically depend on delegated pools, right? Because like if you have one of these chains that like relies on like mandatory delegated pools and there's only 21 validator slots, well, you know, everyone knows that they have no chance in hell of becoming one of the 21. And so, you know, like the idea that like you are a second class participant and like there is this one class of participant that's above you in a formal sense, like that is going to weigh on you to some extent.
Hey guys, I hope you're enjoying the conversation with Vitalik so far. Coming up next, we finish up going through Vitalik's identified sources of legitimacy, just a few left. We also talk about the role of legitimacy inside of NFTs, as well as the power of charitable giving in adding legitimacy to the value of an NFT. And then we also turn to the conversation of legitimacy of the monetary policy of Ether, the asset, and we ask Vitalik, will the most legitimate blockchain have the highest level of security? And overall, we can't miss the opportunity of talking to Vitalik about his thoughts on ultrasound money, but we do it inside of the context of legitimacy. Stay tuned for the second half of this podcast. Don't go anywhere, but first we have to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible. Bankless is proud to be supported by Uniswap. Uniswap is a new paradigm in asset exchange infrastructure. Instead of a cumbersome order book system where trades are matched with other humans, Uniswap is an autonomous piece of software on Ethereum, which is what Ryan and I call a money robot. No human counterparties or centralized intermediaries, just autonomous code on Ethereum. Input the token you want to sell and receive the token you want to buy. Something brand new in the Uniswap ecosystem is the Uniswap Grants program is now accepting applications for grants. We have been saying this for a while and we'll say it again. DAOs have money and they are in need of labor. If you think that you have something to contribute to the Uniswap DAO, apply for a grant to Uniswap. Just look at the size of the Uniswap treasury. It's almost $3 billion. This mountain of capital is looking for labor. Do you have something of value to contribute to the Uniswap DAO? No matter how big or small your idea is, you can apply for a uni grant at unigrants.org and help steer Uniswap in the direction that you think it should go. That's exactly what we did to get Uniswap to be a sponsor for Bankless, and you can do the same for your project. Thank you, Uniswap, for sponsoring Bankless.
Synthetics is Ethereum's derivatives liquidity protocol. What does this mean? Synthetics is a platform for creating and trading synthetic assets. This includes real-world assets like commodities, equities, and currencies. You get access to a global range of assets on a single decentralized platform. Traders could use the Quanta Exchange, which hosts and trades all of the synthetic assets created by Synthetics. Traders on Quanta can trade tokens such as synthetic Bitcoin, synthetic oil, synthetic Tesla, or even synthetic DeFi. Because Quanta is powered by Synthetics, traders experience zero slippage in their trades. No, I don't mean low slippage, I mean no slippage, because that's the power of the Synthetics platform. No slippage on your trades. You can also easily short assets with iSynths. These are synthetic tokens that move inversely to their target asset, or you can simply short by borrowing against SUSD while getting paid a yield to do it. Synthetics isn't just for traders. Developers can build on Synthetics to access the infinite liquidity offered by synthetic assets, where investors can stake collateral to the protocol and earn fees that the protocol collects. If you're a trader and you're looking for a trading platform not found in the legacy world, check out Quanta.io. And if you just want to earn yield on your collateral, go to staking.synthetics.io, where you can stake your SNX or ETH and earn fees from Synthetics. If you want to learn more, head to synthetics.io and join their Discord community. So all of these theories of legitimacy we're talking about so much about we're making analogs to traditional institutions is because legitimacy is the foundation for all traditional institutions. And of course, blockchains, public blockchains cannot, like Ethereum, cannot use legitimacy by brute force. Violence is just not an option. So legitimacy needs to come from all of these other sources that we've just named. The last one, and then we'll continue on with the conversation, is legitimacy by continuity. And I think that's an important, applicable one in crypto. Maybe this has some relationship to what we have called previously the Lindy effect. So the idea that if something is legitimate at time t, by definition, it is legitimate at time t plus one into the future.
And perhaps even more legitimate at t plus one.
Exactly. And so Bitcoiners will say yes, and the Bitcoin network has been humming for the last decade plus, and its monetary policy has not changed. It has continuity, and therefore it is a good store of value. Can you reflect on legitimacy by continuity in time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think legitimacy by continuity is important because it just is the reason why we can have these like social structures that last for like longer than a week at all, right? Like if we did not have legitimacy by continuity at all, then, you know, every political system would be up for like total revaluation, you know, every Tuesday. And if people thought in this way, then like, you know, it'll just be like hard to coordinate things that last longer than a week. And that's like, it's one of those things that we think about the least, because it's just something that like, by definition, happens by default, but it is important, right? And as you said, like the longer a system lasts, then, you know, the longer it does acquire this Lindy value. And, you know, when newer people are coming in and they're trying to like see, you know, what is the system that I should get behind because it's the one that I expect other people to be getting behind. Like it's this long track record of survival is definitely one of the factors that they're taking into consideration.
So Vitalik, the through line that I'm really seeing here with all these different forces that illegitimacy arises from is we call this a social force, and it feels very much like a bottom-up force, a populist force. People choose in these various different mechanisms what is legitimate versus what's not. But is legitimacy explicitly a bottom-up phenomenon? In the article you wrote, in general, legitimacy arises because the thing that gains legitimacy is psychologically appealing to most people. Does that mean that legitimacy is a people-first force?
Legitimacy definitely is something that comes from people first, but two caveats, right? Like, or, well, one caveat, basically, is that the thing that gains legitimacy can be something that's very centralized, right? Like, for example, you know, within the Tron ecosystem, you know, like Justin Sun has a huge amount of legitimacy. Within, you know, the Bitcoin SV ecosystem, Craig Wright has a lot of legitimacy. And of course, the centralized figure can, in a lot of cases, also gain legitimacy by brute force as well, right? Like, it is something that comes from the people, but the consequences that it has and the things that it empowers can be centralized in some way a lot of the time. And so that is something that, like, is worth watching out for.
Right. And so even with a dictatorship where, you know, legitimacy comes from just raw, unbridled power, which the people must be subservient to, even then, it's still kind of a bottom-up force because the collective people identify that there's a lot of power there, and so they should be subservient to it.
Right.
And even then, we've seen instances throughout history where there is this top-down control, and then something happens that allows the people to question that control, and there's a collective shift where everyone realizes that perhaps they actually have the power to determine what's legitimate, and there's a populist uprising.
Right.
And so using these kind of mental models, let's talk about a stable equilibrium. How do we find stable equilibria when it comes to legitimacy and all these other sources of legitimacy that we've gone through?
Again, I think, like, the equilibria are stable most of the time, right? Like, the shift in equilibria is one of those things that's, like, more catastrophist and gradualist, to use an evolutionary analogy, right? It's the sort of thing that kind of is steady for a long time, and then, like, sometimes you can see that when a shift begins, the shift starts off slow at times, and the shift starts slow, and then when the shift gets to a certain critical point, it just happens quickly, right? And the reason why things work this way is because, like, just going back to a kind of my characterization of what the legitimacy phenomenon is, it's a pattern of people behaving in a certain way because they see everyone else behaving in that way. And, like, there is a big risk to stepping out of line alone that doesn't exist if everyone steps out of line at the same time, right? And so if everyone considers some idea or some conception as being legitimate, and that's something that's very strong, then if you start kind of going against it, then you're not likely to have much of an effect, and you're even likely to, like, see, at best, waste time, and at most, like kind of hurt your own interests by going against it. But then the thing that you can do, right, is that you can sort of start, like, dipping your feet a little, and you can start, like, say, publicly questioning the concept slightly, but not actually going against it in your actions. And then once the first person who does that, they do incur some social cost, but then the second person who does that incurs a lower social cost. And so legitimacy starts kind of slowly decreasing over time. And then eventually there does come some critical point where, like, people have done enough public questioning of the concept that it just, it can start flipping from, like, resistance to the old equilibrium being underground to resistance to the old equilibrium being, like, very open and very overground fairly quickly, right? So I think the more interesting way to frame the question is actually not even how do you identify conceptions of legitimacy being stable, because that's the norm. The interesting thing to identify is, like, how do you identify when a big shift in the conception of legitimacy is about to happen. And I think people have an intuitive feel for these things, especially because in the last 5 years or so, in both crypto and in the world in general, like, we've had some of these shifts in legitimacy, and they, like, you know, you can feel it, how these things sort of happen gradually, and then they happen suddenly. And sometimes only when they happen suddenly do you look back and do you realize that, like, hey, these things that people were saying in the two or three years before that actually were a prelude to that.
I think a very relevant current event here is the Alexei Navalny case with Russia and Vladimir Putin right now, where Alexei Navalny was ostracized from Russia. He fled. He was poisoned by the Russian, you know, inner party. Then he comes back to Russia and was immediately jailed and is now perhaps on like the last strings of his life in jail under Vladimir Putin. And what you just said recently was that the first person to question legitimacy probably loses a lot of social power and social force. But then what that person is doing is allows for the people to come after them to more easily question the legitimacy. And if this trajectory flows, Alexei Navalny, who is already a hero of the Russian people, and there's already this showing of solidarity behind this individual, I think a very apt current event to illustrate the power of legitimacy is going on right now in Russia. And I think that it would be a useful mental model for listeners to really understand how legitimacy is flowing in current times.
Right. Yeah. No, it's definitely a really interesting, although of course, you know, very unfortunate for Alexei as well, kind of situation to be watching. It's the question to see is basically, you know, to what extent and or whether or not a serious equilibrium flip does actually happen. Mm-hmm. Right. Like equilibrium flips have happened before in Russia. Like, you know, the whole switch from communism to post-communism was one of those big examples of an equilibrium flip. And, you know, like someone like my dad definitely remembers it how it was out as it was happening. So that's like there's two ways that it could go. Right. Like it could either kind of continue snowballing and eventually, you know, Big V either has to make serious concessions or he kind of actually ends up getting taken out of power somehow. Or, you know, the other possibility, of course, is that like, it does just sort of fizzle over time and the sort of equilibrium does kind of reestablish itself. But even if the equilibrium reestablishes itself, like, I think it definitely would be a shift from kind of like legitimacy by performance, which is the thing that I think did sort of buoy up Putin for the first like 10 years of his presidency, to like be just like clearer kind of just like brute legitimacy by brute force. And that kind of like that kind of switch is something that like can have like bad long-term consequences for him and you know, his government as well. So yeah, I mean, we'll see how it goes, and I definitely you know, wish the best for the Russian people, as you know, I'm Russian myself, but we'll see how this goes.
Another example that I think is kind of visceral that you give in the article is kind of the general in the army example, or maybe a captain in the army. And I really enjoy listening to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. I don't know if you guys have ever
listened to all of them.
Okay, well, amazing. So he did this whole series called King of Kings, and it was basically Persian Assyrian history. Anyway, there are many episodes in that, like hours of listening. If you get bored of Bankless, guys, it's a little, you know, get bored of crypto, go to Dan Carlin. But he gives very visceral examples of what it was like to fight at the front lines of, you know, an ancient army, essentially. And the captain or the commander's main job was social coordination. The captain had to make sure that his troops would not break rank, because if the line broke, there would inevitably be a slaughter. Right. And so the captain would have to have a show of confidence, be, you know, decorated in like, you know, bright armor, be sitting on a horse, and had to instill this confidence, because every soldier, with the prospect of certain death and another army about to come kill them, very nervous at that time. What you're doing as a soldier is you're kind of looking around to your fellow soldiers and you're saying, oh, is he going to run? Is he going to run? Right? So it's like this real time human coordination, social coordination game being played out at the highest stakes. And that was a fascinating example of how I think some of these legitimacy mechanisms almost emerge in human behavior. Can you talk about that a little bit, like sort of the emergence? There's a line from your article that says, with any coordination games that exist for long enough, there inevitably emerge some mechanisms. Mm-hmm. These are not necessarily defined mechanisms in words or legal language, but these are mechanisms nonetheless that emerge. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, I think human behavior in general, and like especially collective behavior, very easily falls into patterns. And it's just something that naturally happens over time, right? And you know, you can see why it happens. Like it's easier for each individual person to just like repeat the same habits that they've grown accustomed to than it is for them to kind of like flip their habits. And it's also easier to continue along a habit because getting an entire group of people to switch is something that's even harder. So the ancient armies are definitely a great example. It's fascinating how, like, while two armies are fighting each other head to head, there's generally not too many casualties, at least immediately. But then once one of the armies like does that equilibrium flip and it starts routing, like that's when the carnage really begins, right? And so, like, whether or not the equilibrium flips is like one of the most important things in a battle, and it's something that the captain has to like, try really hard to prevent, right? And that's one of those cases where, you know, yes, the soldiers are exactly like they're watching each other. They're seeing, you know, who's going to are these people going to run? Are these people not going to run? And, you know, if other people run, but then you start running 5 seconds later, like, guess what? You're at the back of the line and you're the first that's going to like, you know, get a sword or an axe in the back of your spine. But if you start running and other people don't run, then, well, you know, you're a deserter and you're likely to get your head chopped off by your own army at the end of the battle. So it's a perfect example, and it's like really tough to be in that kind of situation. The thing that everyone wants to do is just like see what everyone else is doing, because like they just feel like acting the same way that everyone else acts like just is the okay way to act.
Vitalik, does this explain maximalism almost, or sort of an ardent maximalism? Mm-hmm. David, as before, has called some ardent maximalists like almost like barrier troops, right? Mm-hmm. that prevent your own army from fleeing.
No, that's definitely a fascinating example. Definitely a big, intellectual legitimacy in general is a really important type of legitimacy. And just having people out there just like, you know, saying the rah-rah slogans and like talking about how they're going to fight till the end and how their belief in this cause is unconditional is definitely a way of like just showing the other people in the community that, you know, there is at least this group of people that, you know, is not going to flee before me. So it's safe. It's kind of safe for me to continue being part of this and, you know, continuing to shout the slogans myself. That absolutely is a thing that happens.
Well, but some of it's logical too, and I'll give an example for Bankless listeners. We'll listen a few podcasts ago. We had on Hasu, who is a crypto researcher, also involved in the Ethereum community. Someone who I consider an intellectual, has some fantastic ideas. And toward the end of that episode, he said something that kind of blew my mind. He said that there are many, including himself, in the Bitcoin community that know that the long-term security model of Bitcoin fixed cap is actually flawed. But then he also followed up by this. He said he was reticent to proclaim that it was flawed. And why is the reason? It's not anti-intellectualism. It's because actually acknowledging the problem hastens the demise of Bitcoin, because so much of Bitcoin's economic monetary policy and number go up is because of legitimacy of fixed issuance. So if you break rank and you actually talk about that, even bring it up, you could actually be contributing to the delegitimization of Bitcoin itself. And so it was almost a rational reason why he was reticent to kind of bring it up.
Yep, that's very true.
Vitalik, we were talking about how humans just need to be on the same page in order to create this social force legitimacy. My mind turned to the concept of shelling points. Where do you see the intersection of shelling points and legitimacy? How do you see those concepts as related?
I think legitimacy is a type of shelling point phenomenon. Like, there is definitely some level at which they're almost synonyms, and they're definitely sort of like within the same category of idea space. Shelling points are, you know, just this idea that, like, if you want people to, like, basically people, if they have to coordinate with other people on something, like if they benefit from making the exact same choice as other people, then they would just, like, choose the course of action that just they think it seems the most intuitive to the largest group of people. And like they latch onto just like any conception of intuitiveness that like seems like it's kind of widely shared enough, regardless of, you know, whether or not like they personally agree with it or whether or not it's like logical in some other sense. So his, Thomas Schelling's original example was like, if you, tell someone that, he wants to meet them in New York, but, you don't know what location in New York, like what place should you go to? And the answer that he gave was Grand Central Station. And I guess the theory is that like Grand Central Station is this, it's this big landmark in New York, and it's a landmark that where people know that everyone else knows that it's a big landmark. And so, you know, you're more likely to go there because you're reasoning that the other person is reasoning the same way. Now, of course, to be fair, if I went to New York, I would probably not choose Grand Central Station. I would choose Times Square. And I'm not sure exactly what Grand Central Station is. But like this just shows how these shelling points can be kind of different across different communities. And the conception of legitimacy, I guess, like it's basically the exact same kind of phenomenon. And though it's something that's not just applied to like one-time actions, it's also something that's just applied to these like long ongoing processes. I think the key lesson is just that like this idea that there's just so many different contexts in our like collective human activity where it makes sense to make the same choice as other people, but everyone's trying to make the choice at the same time without having perfect information of everyone else's choice. And so they just have to like latch onto ideas that they expect everyone else to consider intuitive. Like it's just this really important thing, and it affects a huge amount of behavior. And so I think a lot of people in history have kind of identified the importance of this.
And also in this article and in many of your other articles as well, you've used this alternative shelling concept as a shelling fence, which I'm actually unfamiliar with. So maybe you could help us learn what a shelling fence is in contrast to a shelling point and how it relates to legitimacy.
Yeah. So a shelling fence is this idea that like you can go up to it's a common agreement that you can go up to a certain point, but like you can't go further than that point. The shelling fence is actually an ideal analogy because like literal fences, even when they're insecure, are shelling fences in some way, right? Like, because what you imagine, you know, you have two farmers and they both have their farms and there's a fence between those two farms, then like it's beneficial for the two farmers' relationships for them to both agree on like, this is my land and this is your land. And I'm not going to like go and grab things from your land and you're not going to go and grab things from my land. And if there is just any kind of natural landmark, like whether it's a river or even just like whether it's just an actual fence that someone put there, like that's just the fact that it's the most visible landmark just like is the thing that makes it clear that, you know, you're not going to go past like that point. And there's a lot of like one other example of this, like say in the crypto space, might be that you could conceive of a blockchain community where people in that blockchain community are okay with, say, a portion of transaction fees being redirected to a DEF fund, but they would not be okay with issuance going into a DEF fund. And now you might ask, well, like, why this arbitrary distinction, right? Like, transaction fees are like a unit of currency. A blocker reward is a unit of currency. And like, really, 20% of transaction fees is much greater than 0.01 coins of block reward. So why be okay with the first thing, but not be okay with the second thing? And the reason, like, there's a very rational reason to be okay with kind of arbitrary distinctions like this. And the reason basically is, like, it's a slippery slope effect, right? Like, slippery slopes are not fallacies. You know, they're like, it is definitely true that once, if you start accepting that, you know, let's have a 0.01 coin block reward going to a defland, then you've really kind of reduced the strength of the argument against having an even bigger defund. And so if the community agrees that they want a medium-sized defund, but they also still want to kind of keep a barrier that, like, very clearly prevents them from going even further because they want to, you know, protect, like, their monetary legitimacy, then, you know, saying a portion of transaction fees can go to a DEF fund, but a portion of issuance cannot. Like, it's just a very clear dividing boundary. And the existence of that dividing boundary basically allows you to kind of go up to that dividing boundary without compromising on everyone's really strong agreement that you can't do anything beyond that dividing boundary. And so, like, that's one example of something that could happen. Another example of a shelling fence is just, like, zero is a very common shelling fence. So just the fact that, like, you don't want to start doing certain things at all. Like, you don't want to start having a def fund at all. You don't want to start, like, you know, even just, like, doing coin rescues at hard forks at all. Because if you start doing them at all, then you've severely weakened your argument against going further. And then once you go further, you've severely weakened your argument against going even further. And so, like, you just have to, like, put your foot down somewhere and say, like, this is the limit. And oftentimes, like, there isn't a kind of intuitive spot to put that limit except for zero. And so that's why, like, sometimes we just have to agree that, like, you know, we're going to put our foot down and we're going to say zero is the limit, even though from some, so like, a kind of social optimality sense, the best amount might be some number higher than zero, like, just because of limits to coordination, like, zero might just be the number that you choose, right? So, like, these kinds of, like,
Bitcoin's monetary policy, yes, comes to mind.
Yes, that's definitely a great example. Like, you know, there's definitely a lot of Bitcoiners who would be willing to privately admit that, like, yes, Bitcoin would on net be better if you just said there's a 0.1 Bitcoin block reward that continues permanently. But in practice, like, everyone kind of agrees that once you start saying 0.1, then, like, you've really compromised your ability to argue against, say, increasing to 0.5 and then increasing to 2 and then increasing even further. And the fact that everyone kind of, like, believes in this slippery slope itself kind of contributes to everyone's understanding of the strength of not even starting to go down the slippery slope. And so, like, everyone's belief in the shelling fence essentially is the thing that just contributes to the shelling fence being so strong, right? So I definitely expect that, you know, Bitcoin is going to have an extremely hard time going beyond the 21 million coin limit. Like, I actually think that, you know, if Bitcoin has a security crisis, so there start being successful 51% attacks against it, like, there's basically three choices that they could take, right? Choice one is compromising on 21 million. Choice two is just accepting the attacks. And choice three is moving to at least hybrid proof of stake. And, I mean, I expect that there is a higher chance that they'll, if there is a security crisis, they'll move to hybrid proof of stake, just because, you know, even if the kind of, like, the core Bitcoinerati really hate proof of stake, like, just the fact that Ethereum and the fact that all these other platforms are running it, are using it without a problem, actually does contribute to its legitimacy. But if that did not happen, right, if like the hybrid proof of stake route was also out of the question, like, they would much rather just accept the attacks than they would accept a even slight issuance increase, just because of these shelling fences. Like, basically, like, there's parts of the Bitcoin community that are even actively against making a shelling fence about any specific guarantee of security, right? Like, they even explicitly say things like, oh, you know, the Bitcoin blockchain is explicitly something that never finalizes. And so even reverting a week of activity is something that does not, like, explicitly violate the Bitcoin blockchain stated guarantees, which I think to an Ethereum person, like, sounds very insane. And I think in the Ethereum case, you know, if like there was a 51% attack that reverted a week of activity, we would just do a hard fork, right? Or at least a soft fork that just like deleted the attacking chain. But so like that's just like an example where I think like in the Ethereum case, like just finality and a non-reversion is something just like is a stronger part of the social contract. And like you could even imagine a blockchain community that says, you know, we have a hard community norm against reversions longer than 24 hours. And so if the proof of work system reverts more than 24 hours, well, too bad, we're going to have to hard fork it. And if that happens, like that's just another example of like how, you know, like if you set the fence, then like that fence itself becomes like one of these self-reinforcing things that's really powerful. And so like how you set the norms at the beginning is just really important.
I think the two Ethereum examples, one at the start of this was the block reward to developers EIP did not get community traction and did not move forward. And that was sort of a shelling fence.
I agree.
Back to the 0-1. Another example is probably, you sort of alluded to this, but the Parity wallet hack, that was an EIP that did not move forward because the question to the community for the shelling fence is, okay, then where does it stop? Which hack do we decide to bail out? Which do we not? Let's just keep it at zero and not bail anybody out.
I've got a wallet that has some Ether in it that I would like to get back. Can I submit an EIP for this?
I think the EIP 999 case was interesting, right? Because the DAO fork, like it did compromise the shelling fence of like basically no state intervention. And that is something that made a lot of people upset. And that is something that made a lot of people move to ETC. But even the people who did not move to ETC, like they were kind of scared as a result. And so I think the rejection of EIP 999 was in part motivated by this desire to like reestablish a shelling fence and say, you know, yes, we did the DAO fork, but you know, no, despite that, we have standards. And like, I think that was effective. Like, I think that's something that a lot of Bitcoiners were not expecting. Like they really were expecting that, you know, if you do it once, you just keep doing it forever. But, you know, no, like EIP 999 not happening, like it did convince a lot of people that like, you know, it like the DAO fork happened once, but that does not mean that like Ethereum chain intervention is a free for all. So that was an interesting situation as well.
So Vitalik, say the whole world will listen to this podcast and hopefully that happens. And now the whole world is informed about this this power called legitimacy. Mm-hmm. And now that we have this name on it, we can actually discuss it and talk about it in a more manifested sense. What can humans do with legitimacy? Like if everyone understands that this force exists, can we harness it? Like what if we had more legitimacy in the world? What does it mean to be more legitimate? If we can harness this power, what could we do with it?
So one very important form of legitimacy in the world is property rights, right? Like property rights are something that like sits on top of legitimacy, right? Like people are not going to be able to like successfully conquer your house and maintain your position inside the house because like there are these conceptions of legitimacy where the police know that if someone conquers your house and sets up camp in it, they have to come in and dislodge them. And then they know this because they know that if they don't do this, then other people in the government are going to yell at them and they're going to do it themselves. And then at some point it escalates to the military. And then if the military doesn't do that, then the government's going to get voted out of office. So there's this kind of towering set of expectations, and it even towers internationally to some extent that are protecting your house, right? And so if that conception of legitimacy did not exist, then, you know, yes, like someone who had more guns can like just like conquer your house and set up shop inside of it. So the interesting thing about property rights is that just because of like new technology, you often see new property rights or the need for new property rights emerging, right? So like one example of this is we could talk about Antarctica, right? So right now Antarctica is this backwater that very few people care about, and it's mostly just like a place for scientific research. But there's a possibility that within half a century, Antarctica is going to become more important. So a big part of the reason why is global warming, right? So the climate is expected to warm by several degrees over the course of the next few decades. And like people have done the analysis of like how this is going to affect the temperature and livability of different places. And Western Antarctica, like that peninsula that's like just 1,000 kilometers south of South America, is expected to potentially become is somewhat a viable place for settlement like within half a century, right? And so as one of the interesting secondary consequences of global warming is that we could actually see Antarctica becoming this like thing that people care about considerably more than they did before. Now, the problem right now is that like there aren't really strong conceptions of property rights around Antarctica because like just not enough people care about doing anything with Antarctica that like it like on the at current margins, it's not rivalrous basically, right? But eventually, like we can imagine a future where Western Antarctica becomes rivalrous and like you will need a conception of property rights. So
you could also extend this to the moon or space or other areas exactly. of unconquered property.
So like one thing that we could agree on for like Antarctica right now is we could just say, hey, how about we agree right now that we're going to like say have some global body, could be the UN, could be some special purpose separate thing, put harbinger taxes on Antarctica and just like instead of just giving it to whoever comes first, you just like put this sort of like permanent sort of like half ownership, half lease type mechanism on it. And then the revenues from the harbinger tax will just go into a global basic income, right? So if you do this, then you've basically created this global basic income fund. And like you could imagine every person in the world, you know, gaining like probably not enough money to eat, but like at least, you know, some like tens of dollars a year. And if that happens, like that's something that could be good for humanity, right? But in order to arrange something like that, like you do need to have some conception of legitimacy. Like you need to have a wide enough common agreement that, you know, Western Antarctica would actually be a kind of like, or property rights in Western Antarctica would be managed under this scheme that has revenue going to this place that then distributes it among everyone and gives everyone a basic income that. These property rights like would actually just be valid, right? Because if it's only a few people trying to implement this, but like actually, you know, just like some powerful country comes in and says like, you know, yeah, no, this thing's ours, then like that it's not going to succeed, right? And so, like that's just like one possible example of like something where if you start a kind of like engaging in public discourse and sort of shoring up legitimacy behind this idea that, you know, if Western Antarctica becomes important, then we're going to harbinger tax it and give everyone a basic income, then like that increases the chance that actually does become the equilibrium that happens. But on the other hand, if no one starts talking about it, then like that's just not going to happen and you'll get a result that's probably less interesting.
I think what we're getting from that is what can we do with more legitimacy is we can play better social coordination games. Mm-hmm. And that's what human beings are really good at. That's how we found success as a species. Let's talk a bit more about crypto, because I think what we're unlocking in this concept of legitimacy with the post and the description thus far is, I'm not going to say a theory to everything, but it's an answer to many of the FAQs that I hear when people first come into crypto. So let me give an example, a couple we've covered. One is like, why can't Ethereum just issue an EIP and fund its public goods that way? And we can't because of legitimacy. You gave another example of, you know, why can't a bank, for instance, acquire a DeFi protocol? Well, they can't. We have the Steam versus Justin Sun example because the thing that they're acquiring is actually social consensus, and they can't just buy legitimacy. They almost have to earn it. Mm-hmm. Here's another question I think people ask when they get in the space. And this was a common question in 2013, 2014 about why Bitcoin is valuable. And some critics have said back then, especially, Bitcoin will never be valuable because anybody can just create a fork, right? I could take my Bitcoin and then say, this is the legitimate Bitcoin and it's called Bitcoin Ryan. And like that turned out to be completely not true because of legitimacy. Would you agree with that?
Definitely. Well, so the interesting thing also is that like there's Bitcoin maximalists who said that, you know, for Bitcoin to maintain its value, like Bitcoin has to be accepted as the only one, because if people start accepting the legitimacy of other cryptocurrencies, then like the ability of Bitcoin to maintain any kind of special status just like disappears. If people start acting like they're all the same and cryptocurrency as a sector hyperinflates. And we discovered that that's completely not true, right? Like anyone can print a new cryptocurrency, but printing a new cryptocurrency that has the legitimacy to gain value is something that actually is hard, right? And it's something that takes a lot of effort. It's something like that not everyone can do. And it is very possible for, you know, Bitcoin to have a lot of legitimacy, Bitcoin Cash to have less legitimacy, Bitcoin ABC to have even less, but still non-zero legitimacy. And then, you know, Bitcoin Ryan would probably like, I mean, I'm sure if you memed it, it would like get up to a few $100,000, but like, you know, even less legitimacy like than Bitcoin Diamond or Bitcoin ABC, basically, right? So like there being multiple cryptocurrencies is something that has proven to be a stable equilibrium, which is, I think, something that a lot of people, like given especially very early in the crypto space, did not expect.
I also think another example of this is many of the Ethereum killers that have come about talk about, they emphasize their technology, right? More scalability, this sort of thing. And they don't emphasize legitimacy. Mm-hmm. They don't emphasize social scalability. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they think this is purely a technical battle, but it's not. It's a legitimacy battle. Mm-hmm. It's a social coordination battle. It's about where the developers of the future feel comfortable, like build which platform they feel comfortable building on top of, and where the users feel comfortable actually using without losing their property rights. Another example, you gave an example in the post that I think is interesting, which is, why do DeFi apps, it seems like, prefer DAI rather than Tether? Legitimacy.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing I gave in that example, right, is that like traders are often perfectly fine with Tether, but dApps are strongly prefer DAI over Tether. And the reason is that legitimacy is fundamentally about coordination, and traders don't really have to coordinate, right? They're just like trading, and their main interaction with other traders is competitive. And so, like, for a trader, like, if you personally believe that, like, well, you know, maybe Tether has some sketchiness inside of it, but like, meh, whatever, it's fine, then like, that's fine, and you can just keep using Tether. But for if you're building an application, then you need something that not just you can trust, but that like you can easily convince other observers and even like fairly low information observers that you're building on top of something sound. And so like something like DAI, where its legitimacy model doesn't fundamentally rely on, you know, very socially unscalable assumptions about like how honorable Bitfinex people are, like there's something like it's just easier to get behind.
I think we can also extrapolate the confusion perhaps behind NFTs and why NFTs have value and answer that question with legitimacy. And a nice example that I like to use is the creator of the Nyan Cat GIF. He made this Nyan Cat GIF many, many, many years ago. And then recently he remastered it. So he made a brand new GIF, the brand new GIF. And then he sold that brand new GIF for 300 ETH. And there's two sources of legitimacy that I see coming into this GIF. One is continuity, where even though it's a brand new GIF, it continues from the same meme of the Nyan Cat that has almost been around for a whole entire decade. Mm-hmm. And legitimacy as the artist who created the NFT in the first place. It was the original artist who remastered the Nyan Cat GIF, not some new unknown artist. And I think we can extrapolate this to most all NFTs at large, where it's not about the JPEG. It's about the legitimacy. And so, Vitalik, how do you see legitimacy in NFTs intersecting?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an excellent example, right? Because like the question is like, first of all, you know, an NFT of a Nyan Cat is clearly more successful than the same author making an NFT of some completely new turtle meme. But second, a Nyan Cat meme made by the author of the original Nyan Cat meme is more successful than just like some random person doing it, right? And so like, there's legitimacy in the meme, there's legitimacy in the person, and you know, there's other kinds of legitimacy as well, and they do sort of kind of add up and stack on top of each other. Now, the reason why legitimacy is important in NFTs is because if you look at the reasons why anyone would want an NFT in the first place, right? Like one of them is you're more likely to buy an NFT if you know that you can resell it later. Another one is you want an NFT for like social bragging rights. And all of these, basically all of the motivations for why you could conceivably want an NFT are like very closely bound up with the fact that other people also accept that this is an NFT that should have a value, right? And so, you know, even if like you personally think that a purple hexagon is something that's like really important to the world and is something that should be worth billions, like nobody else agrees that purple hexagons should be worth billions. And so, you know, you're not going to spend much money buying a purple hexagon NFT because like you might get a bit of personal satisfaction, but because nobody else cares about purple hexagons, like your level of personal satisfaction will be limited and your ability to resell it will also be extremely limited and probably zero as well. And we see these kind of like conformism patterns occurring in markets all the time, right? Like, for example, one of the reasons why houses tends to be relatively standardized and uncreative is because when you buy a house, like you want to buy a house that you can sell easily. And then the person you're selling to also wants a house that they know that they can sell easily. And so if you buy a house that is conforms to the average person's expectations of a house, then not only do you know that you can easily find someone who would want to live in it, you know that you can sell it to someone else because you can easily convince the person that you're selling to that they might later be able to sell it along to someone else as well, right? And so, like, you can often, like, get these sort of effects that just, like, kind of prop up the value of some houses over others for a long time. And these are just, like, these sort of second layer equilibria that just, exist on top, weird social forces. And with NFTs, it's true as well, right? And so with NFTs, if someone else made a Nyan Cat NFT, then it would be much harder for you to resell it. And like, you would just gain much less social satisfaction from having it. And so just for all of the reasons, it's much less valuable. And so what this means is that NFTs are kind of heavily defined by legitimacy. And if we can affect these conceptions of legitimacy, then we could potentially kind of turn NFTs in or at least nudge NFTs into something that's really useful for just like funding or funneling valuable resources into things that are valuable for society, right? So like one example that I gave is if we create a conception that an NFT is more legitimate if it's kind of connected to some nonprofit organization and some portion of the revenues go to that organization. And if people accept that like NFTs with this property are like more legitimate because they're like more scarce in some way than NFTs that do not have this connection, then that's like, if that equilibrium exists, then that's something that will just end up like funneling resources to more of these nonprofit organizations. And like trying to actively participate in trying to create these equilibria is something that we should be like really, I think, focused on and like interested in trying to make happen.
What you're saying, I've seen this in the analog space. There's a brand called Red. I don't know if you've seen this, but there was a period of time where like Starbucks was branding their coffee Red and you'd see Red everywhere. And I believe that's a nonprofit where some portion of the donation from that product went to AIDS. And now I think it's COVID-19. But that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right? Where they branded all of these products and increased demand because now I buy my Starbucks and I'm feeling like I am actually giving back to something that I support, something like that for NFTs.
Absolutely.
I'm reminded of like the event where when somebody buys a new boat, they swing a bottle of champagne and it breaks upon the boat. And it's like this christening event for this boat. And it has nothing to do with legitimacy, but with an NFT, when you are selling this NFT and you're committing some amount of funds to charity, it feels like a christening event of this NFT. You use the term bless in your article, where you are blessing this NFT, bestowing it with legitimacy. And what was interesting to me is not a week after you published this article did the Uniswap V3 X times Y equals K NFT come out. And not only was a chunk of that revenue of that NFT donated to charity, all of it was donated to charity. Do you think that like if we want to give some actionable advice to NFT artists, that it would actually behoove them from a revenue maximalist perspective to donate some of their NFT sale revenue to charities?
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, I think it's even one of those things that could sort of like flow in one direction, because if nobody else is making an NFT going to charity and you make an NFT where some part goes to charity, then, you know, just by that fact, your NFT is special and people are more likely to pay attention to it. But then if lots of people are already making NFTs that go to charity, then, you know, that fact just like gains with the fact that an NFT is supposed to be blessed by some charity becomes like this part of its legitimacy. And just like, by that pressure as well, you know, it ends up being just like more effective to make an NFT where some portion goes to a charity. So this is something that like I'm hoping not just NFT artists think about, but even like major NFT platforms think about, like just incorporating like some notion of you know, flagging NFTs that have been blessed by a charity as being that, and just making this very clear to buyers. Like, I think if this is something that can be coordinated among, I think, a relatively small number of actors in the ecosystem, then you know, the results could be really interesting.
So, Vitalik, I think the Bankless community would also love your thoughts on another subject that I feel like is actually very quite related to legitimacy. And that's a topic that has been top of mind for the last couple of months. And that is the topic of ETH as ultrasound money. Right. So this is kind of I'd call it a narrative that, you know, is that Justin Drake actually helped define it. I think you had some role in actually naming this concept as well. But the way it relates to legitimacy is I have sent that podcast to many Bitcoiners I know, and I've invited many who have been previously skeptical about Ethereum and its future guarantees, security guarantees, monetary guarantees, or otherwise, to listen to it. And I've asked for feedback. Mm-hmm. And many don't listen to it, of course. Many don't go down the journey. But those who do generally have a consistent piece of feedback, and that is this. The monetary policy is still illegitimate of Ethereum because it's being changed, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that it can be tweaked at this point is outside of sound money behavior, as kind of defined by Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about that for a minute? I guess maybe the context is ultrasound money, but also like, what do you think a legitimate issuance policy looks like for a cryptocurrency?
I think that's definitely a great question. And I think you know, the concept of legitimacy is definitely really important to like this ultrasound question in like a bunch of really subtle ways, right? I think the key thing that's important here is that there is a shift of legitimacy in thinking of ETH as you know, a type of money of any kind, right? Like closer to the beginning of Ethereum's history, ETH was more viewed as like basically this thing that you would use to pay for gas, but not really something that, you know, you would actually want to use as an asset. And over time, this is, I think, a push from the community much more than it is anything happening from, you know, the Ethereum Foundation or the core developers. Actually, I think it's entirely a push from the community, is that people just started like talking about, you know, ETH as an asset and like basically wanting to confer inherent legitimacy to ETH as an asset more and more. And I think the place where the ultrasound money kind of meme and the discussion around how proof of stake and EIP 1559 fit into that is that those things, like even now, they signal a commitment to the fact that a large portion of the Ethereum ecosystem like wants ETH to be ultrasound money. And like, an asset having a community that wants it to be an ultrasound money is a good property for an ultrasound money to have. right? Like an asset is more effective as an ultrasound money if it has a big portion of its community talking about how that asset is ultrasound money, because that community talking about the ultrasound money meme itself basically makes it be part of the social contract and makes it more likely that things that are supportive of that asset becoming ultrasound money will be implemented, and things that are opposed to that asset being ultrasound money will not be implemented, right? So I think just ETH gaining legitimacy through this self-created ultrasound money concept is definitely a thing that is happening. Now, of course, legitimacy is always something that's different in different communities. And I think there definitely is a cultural difference between the Ethereum and Bitcoin communities, right? Because I think Ethereum people are more accustomed to valuing Ethereum based on its future, whereas Bitcoin people are much more accustomed to valuing Bitcoin based on its present, right? Like I've expressed this before as Bitcoin people think Bitcoin is 80% complete. Ethereum people think Ethereum is 40% complete. And both sides are comfortable with that and think the other side is crazy for taking the opposite choice, right? And so at least within the Ethereum community, the fact that there is intent to do 50-59 and the proof of stake switch and to bound issuance and all of this stuff is already enough for them, right? Like it's the intent and direction of the social contract that's even the most important thing. Whereas I imagine to the Bitcoin audience, until it's implemented in code, it doesn't count. And maybe that's fine. I think
they almost feel like Vitalik, until it's implemented, coded, and 20 years have passed.
Yes.
It's not fine.
I think that's definitely true. Yeah. Bitcoin people are definitely just less comfortable with the concept of social contracts defining a direction instead of defining a permanent state. And the Ethereum social contract for at least the first 10 years of its existence, the last six and the next few as well, is one that defines a direction, right? The social contract has included proof of stake and sharding from since before the Ethereum blockchain launched. Now, over time, I do think that the Ethereum social contract is going to switch to one that's more of maintenance. And that's just something that has to happen over time, because once we do have proof of stake, there isn't a proof of something that's even better than proof of stake that we want to switch to. And once we have sharding, if we want more scalability, you just add more shards, right? And so there isn't something even better that you want to make big fundamental economic upgrades to after those upgrades are done. And once we have proof of sharding and proof of stake, we have what I call functionality escape velocity, right? And so anything that you want on top, you actually can implement with layer two protocols. So there's less need to make further changes to layer one, right? So for those reasons, I do think that the Ethereum social contract is going to move toward being a stabilizing one instead of being a directional one over time. And once it does that, then I expect a lot of the Bitcoin people that are more comfortable with a stabilizing social contract are just going to slowly accept Ethereum as being legitimate. And I think Ethereum successfully completing its two biggest shifts, so the EAP 1559 and the introduction to proof of stake and possibly sharding as well, that's the thing that's going to actually sort of do most of the work in convincing them, basically.
It's funny to me because it seems to be the case that if given issuance policy is fixed and the security issues that result of that, Bitcoin is going to have to revert to its social contract to decide a direction in the future. You talked about three possible paths for Bitcoin: increasing issuance, letting transactions essentially take a long time to process, or reverting to some proof of stake, proof of work. So it's almost like it's all social consensus and social contract at the base layer anyway. And there's no such thing as completely immutable code that doesn't change.
Yeah, no, it's definitely social contracts all the way down. And you can have different kinds of social contracts. You can have social contracts that prescribe more rigidness. Like, you could have a social contract that says, you know, if a block cannot be verified by this ZK SNARK verifier, where the GitHub hash of the code is 0x5a1c84c, blah, 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 then it is not Bitcoin or it is not whatever currency. Where, like, you could be really, really strict and try to, like, define a piece of code as being the social contract. And that's good for preventing change. But then the problem is, like, well, if the code even has a bug, then, you know, like, just any kind of technical unexpected situation is just going to cause huge problems for your community and possibly even, you know, lead to a chain split. And that's a cost you incur if you have an overly rigid social consensus. But if you have a social contract that just says, you know, we vaguely care about these values and we're just going to do whatever we need to do to implement those values, then that's something that's more adaptable to just changes in circumstances and changes in technology. But that also is something that just gives participants in the ecosystem fewer guarantees. And especially if participants in the ecosystem just like have different views about what it actually takes to realize those values, right? And so there is this trade-off, like there is such a thing as social contracts being more rigid and social contracts being more loose, and there's benefits from one and there's benefits from the other. And I think in general, like blockchain social contracts should be more loose when a blockchain is new and still rapidly growing, and they should kind of just naturally allow themselves to evolve to being more rigid over time as a blockchain discovers what it's for, and that's perfectly fine.
In my episodes, in my other podcast, POV Crypto with Christian Carolas, we talked about this subject of social contracts when he was very adamant that Bitcoin is not ruled by social contract, it's ruled by math. But we actually came to an agreement when I proposed this alternative to him, where I said, Bitcoin social contract is to not have a social contract, which kind of gets to what Bitcoin wants to be, which is ruled by math. But still, like you said, it's social contracts all the way down. Social contracts are unavoidable. The best thing that you could do, which kind of goes back to how a zero is a good shelling point, the social contract to not have a social contract is the best way to not have a social contract, but you still have a social contract.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
That's a show clip, David.
Yeah, no, it's definitely fascinating. Like, I think, you know, we all agree that, like, at the end of the day, there is a lot of, like, pretending going on. Like, you know, in reality, when quantum computers come in, they are going to take some very kind of directed emergency action to protect people's coins. There's some 51% miner that just like starts spawn capping the chain, they're going to take a very directed action to change the proof of work algorithm. And so there are these like things at the extremes that are obviously going to happen. But like this, there is this social contract of like, well, you know, let's like not even talk about the extremes and let's sort of like maintain the mindset that these extremes do not exist. And like, for as long as that survives, like that, the idea is that just like increases the social pressure against like forcing a change by trying to claim that there's some extreme that justifies it. So it's interesting. Like, it's definitely one way of designing a social system, but I guess you know, we'll see how it goes.
Vitalik, I want to back up and zoom out a little bit. A second ago, you were talking about how the ETH can be money if the community wants it to be money. And I'm reminded of I actually asked you the same question back in Tel Aviv in early 2020 when you were on a Q&A panel with Joe Lubin. And you had said something along the lines of how like the Bitcoin could take the monetary use cases of blockchains and Ethereum can take anything else. And I raised my hand and I said, well, I'm part of this crew that really thinks that Ether could be a really compelling money above and beyond beyond Bitcoin. And actually, Ryan was really the first person to just instantiate, and it started just, I'm pretty sure, with a tweet, ETH is money. And that meme just caught like wildfire. And to me, it became very, very obvious that at least there's this core group of Ethereum community members who believe ETH is money and that ETH is money is legitimate. And that was a year and a half ago. And I think that the narrative around ETH as money, as well as the fundamentals, which is what backs up legitimacy, has really matured and evolved since then.
And so now that we are at this like the early 2021 phase with EIP-1559 on the horizon and proof of stake merge around the corner, do you think the world is ready to accept Ether as a brand new macro store value asset alongside Bitcoin in public consciousness?
I would say it's definitely getting there. And I think that like to get the acceptance really up there, we do actually need to finish EIP-1559 and finish the merge and like get to the point where, you know, the system after all of the big changes is running and it's stable and people see that it's stable. But like, it's not gonna, it's very hard for something to gain legitimacy while there's still this roadmap to like change everything a few months into the future. Like, I do think that we are already getting some of the benefits. So like, for example, you know, people have been talking a lot about environmental issues of proof of work, right? And like, I mean, I think that issue is really substantial. And I think like it's, there's actually a lot of different externalities that are pretty negative from a proof of work, right? Like people focus on electricity, and in some ways, electricity is even one of the easiest ones to like argue against because like, oh, you know, we have solar power and oh, we have all of this power in far off places where sometimes it just gets wasted already. But like you have to remember that in addition to the electricity issues, which there's also the hardware issues. Hardware is a huge portion of mining costs. So, you know, last time I made checks, it was even something like 2/3 of them. I'm not sure exactly what the percentage is now. But like hardware is very environmentally unfriendly to manufacture. There's also like displacement issues, like work that's being done on producing these things is being done instead of work that could be done by the computing industry to make things that benefit humanity more. You know, gamers are having a hard time not getting dealing with a reduced supply of PCs. And then, you know, with ASICs as well, like if people weren't working on Bitcoin ASICs, what other kind of ASICs would they be working on? And proof of stake does actually solve these issues. And so I do think that the Ethereum is gaining some kind of like at least the beginnings of interest as some kind of alternative because people see that this is a shift that's coming. And, you know, basically, if it, you know, it is a sort of do or die thing, right? Like, you know, Ethereum is going to either complete the switch or it's going to die trying. And that's the fact that that roadmap exists and the fact that that roadmap is looking more and more credible now that we have a running beacon chain, now that we just finished the Berlin hard fork and we're literally on the finish line to 1559, and then after that, we'll be on the finish line to the merge. You know, the fact that there is a hackathon implementing the merge happening right now, those things definitely are contributing, and those effects will just like become slowly more and more real in people's minds over time as the event gets closer. And then the event happening by itself will obviously be a really huge flip. So that's going to be interesting to watch.
Yeah, people forget that legitimacy, particularly for institutions like public blockchains and the store value assets that they might represent. I mean, this is going to take years to play out, mm-hmm. many, many years. And we are so early in this. There is, it's almost a sense of like, there's no rush. It would be unhealthy to me mm-hmm. if the world suddenly adopt these things as store value assets, mm-hmm. like overnight, right? Yep. This has to happen in a gradual way. Mm-hmm. Vitalik, thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts on legitimacy. I think this is going to be a fantastic mental model for people to try to understand what's going on in this space. I want to end with this question. It's 2021. We are in still the first half, but getting close to the second half. In the grand scheme of things, how would you characterize this era of Ethereum?
I think it's like the era where the ecosystem is like really growing up and starting to enter its phase of maturity. And I think it's happening in a lot of ways, right? Like it's happening because the technical roadmap is finally at least seeing its first major pieces get finished. It's happening because scalability is finally looking months away from actually happening. It's happening because we're actually seeing applications of like serious value and to not just the crypto community, but to the mainstream starting to emerge. The whole NFT thing, I think, was actually really interesting for Ethereum, because it actually is the thing that sort of started giving Ethereum some legitimacy in its own right. Right. Like before the NFT thing, I think people mostly talked about Ethereum in reference to talking about Bitcoin. Right. You know, there's, you have an article about Bitcoin and you just mention, you know, oh, there's also these other cryptocurrencies that exist. And then there's this thing called Ethereum. And then there's, you know, this thing called Cardano. And then there's this thing called Pickup Truck Dano. And then, you know, you keep going.
And they're all the same thing. They're all just these other cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And with NFTs, like, you know, you actually have a reason to talk about Ethereum without reference to, you know, talking about its big brother, which is interesting. Right. So then even aside from NFTs, there's other things happening as well. Right. Like there's just more people experimenting with ETH as a payment mechanism. Like we saw the announcements from, like, I think it was PayPal and some of these other, like, you know, big US companies. They're not just accepting Bitcoin. They're accepting like Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, Ether and Litecoin at the same time. And like, I think that set of four is just fascinating because like, the sort of holdover legitimacy by continuity that Bitcoin Cash and Litecoin just like get that allows them to be accepted is just like so fascinating and interesting to observe. Seeing that start to happen is really interesting. And, you know, I expect that applications are going to continue to mature once scalability is ready. Then the applications are really going to go into overdrive. And then once the EIP 1559 and proof of stake is complete, including the merge being complete, then, you know, the ultrasounds money thing will, instead of like just being a technical goal, actually becomes real. And seeing that happen at the same time is just going to be really interesting for the ecosystem.
Absolutely. We are at an exciting juncture for sure. Vitalik, thank you so much for sharing this with us from a macro perspective. It definitely feels like public blockchains, Ethereum, crypto as an asset class is entering the world of legitimacy. And this decade is going to be super exciting. So thanks for hanging with us today.
Thank you very much, Ryan. Thank you, David.
Cheers.
Action items for the Bankless community. We've got some reading assignments. Make sure you check out Vitalik's post. The most important scarce resource is legitimacy. That's where he goes through the details that we talked about today. Also, read one of his Reddit threads. This was a brain dump that he made on proof of stake versus proof of work. I think after listening to the ultrasound money post, a lot of great comments from the community there too. And then we've got almost like a Vitalik Bankless anthology brewing. There are a few episodes where Vitalik went through why proof of stake, designing Ethereum, his reflections on 2020 and crypto and beyond. We will include all of those resources for you in the show notes. Of course, guys, risks and disclaimers. This is not financial advice. ETH is risky. Crypto is risky. So is DeFi. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone. But thanks for joining us on the Bankless journey.